everybody. The joint session of the House State Affairs Committee and the Senate State Affairs Committee will please come to order. And I'd like to call the roll, please, of the House State Affairs Committee. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gaddis?
Gaddis, here.
Representative Isaacson?
Here.
I can't hear her.
Representative
Price-Thompson? Here. Okay. Very fine. Again, I'd like to welcome everybody here. It's going to be a very productive meeting. I'd like to thank Senator Dyson for being a spark plug behind this meeting. And with that, it's my honor to turn the gavel over to my friend and colleague, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Lynn. Here from the Senate, we have myself, Chair Dyson, Senator Giesel, Senator Coghill, and I believe Senator Stedman and Wilkowski will join us later. And I'd like to introduce my committee aide, Ken Truitt, back there. He is an attorney who is in practice here in the state for 20 years. Let the record reflect Senator Wilkowski has joined us. Representative Christ-Tompkins. And we have once again Nancy Jones here taking minutes and record of our meeting, and in that regard, I'd like everyone who testifies to speak up and identify yourself to help her. And from the LIO, we have Stephanie Gavin. Is that how you say it, Stephanie? Who will be handling all of the people offline and so on, plus the speakers and everything. I appreciate it if you all would turn off your cell phones, particularly the ones that have obnoxious ringtones. And and Nancy Manley is here representing Chair Lynn. Where are you? Yeah, all right. That was a lady that was distributing information here just a moment ago. Is Commissioner Sullivan here or going to be here? All right. So this morning we're going to be talking about the RS-244 issues and leading off will be Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner at DNR. He's responsible overseeing five divisions: agricultural, forestry, mining, land and water, parks and rec, and support services. Wow. And then Scott Ogan, who's been a friend of mine for 16 years at least, and he served here in the Senate and was in fact, as I remember, a chair of resources. And he leads the Department of Natural Resources Lands Navigability Project. The mission is to protect the public rights associated with navigable public waters and to assure that the state's title to lands beneath navigable waters is protected. Thank you for your service in the past and certainly in this mission. My opinion that what we're doing, you gentlemen are doing, is very important. Eisenhower said famously, "Don't let the pressing keep you from doing what the important." And I think this legislature is really working on what's pressing, but in the long term, what you all are doing may indeed be amongst the most important. Who's going to lead off? Mr. Fogle, identify yourself for the record here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ed Fogles. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, Representative Lynn also, and the members of the committee. It's an honor to be here. It's a great joint committee here. I appreciate the work that you're doing. I'm going to start off a little bit. I know on Tuesday we had the first session of this committee, at least the Senate version, and we were left with a few questions on Alaska's land history, so I'm going to run through kind of a little more of an in-depth history of how we got to where we are with our land position. I have a few other items I'd like to bring to your attention as far as issues with federal overreach and what we're doing. And then when I'm done with that, I will turn it over to Scott Ogan, and we also have Mr. Kent Sullivan here, who's an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law, who's been instrumental in our efforts to assert our RS-2477 rights of way.
And so which of the several packets you've given us are you going to show us first?
I'm going to run through this this presentation right now. It's federal overreach and resource development in Alaska.
Right.
And that's what I will start off with. That's the one.
All right. Proceed, please.
Okay, and if the second slide, and the first slide is a cover slide, the second slide is the Alaska Statehood Act. And that's where my presentation starts. I mean, there's quite a bit of history before Alaska statehood, since the purchase of Alaska in 1867. There are a couple of notable events that I'll just run through quickly. In 1884, Congress extended the federal mining law to Alaska, which allowed mining development and mining claims to be staked. Then in 1903, the federal government allowed homesteading in Alaska. These are two very pivotal events in Alaska's modern history. There were a lot of federal conservation system units, national parks and refuges that were put in place before statehood, such as Mount McKinley, Glacier Bay, NPRA, several wildlife refuges, Katmai, Kenai, Kodiak, and then the two national forests, the Tongass and the Chugach. So there was a fair bit of federal sort of conservation pattern already developing before statehood.
Excuse me, but as I remember, the NPRA, that was not a scenic park in a typical sense. It was set aside as a Naval Petroleum Reserve, as I remember, to hopefully guarantee a fuel for our Navy.
Correct.
Yeah,
correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. So then in July 7th, 1958, President Eisenhower did sign the Alaska Statehood Act. And the act originally gave Alaska 103 million acres of a land entitlement. And then with subsequent legislation, that was expanded to the 105.8 million acres of land that is now our current entitlement. We were given 25 years to make our selections. Subsequent legislation actually extended this to 1994, and that was the date that we were supposed to finalize our selections. It wasn't the date that we were supposed to get our land. It was just by that time we weren't allowed to adjust our selections or select new lands. So I'm going to talk about this a little bit more in the presentation, but just to sum it up, as of today, we have received about 5.5 million acres of our entitlement. So the vast majority is in state hands. So we're left with the last little 5 million acre piece.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I understanding you to say that has been given us free, clear title to those lands? We actually have them in our possession, or they're still selected, waiting transfer?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, that 100 million acres that we have is state land. It has been transferred to the state. Now, there are two stages to that. When we first get land from the federal government, it's what's referred to as interim conveyed, IC land, or tentatively approved. And it hasn't been surveyed yet. It has not been patented yet. And probably the vast majority of our state lands right now are TA'd lands. And that gives us full management rights to that land, and there's legal precedent for that. To actually patent it has to be surveyed, and the Bureau of Land Management is slowly going through and surveying the lands and giving us clear patent to those lands. I don't know the exact breakdown between patented and TA lands, but yeah, basically even the TA lands we have full management authority to take a state mining claim on there. We can develop, we can sell it, we can put it in the state park, whatever we want to do with it, it's our land.
Follow up. So a TA land, you said we could sell it without restriction, but we can't give them a clear title.
We do not have patent to it at that time, but per federal law, we have full management authority and disposal rights. We can sell it. So sooner or later, that will get surveyed out and patented, and then, you know, the title chain will be totally clear. But it has not prevented us from doing anything to date that that we need to do with our lands.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 5.5 million remaining acres, what's the plan for that?
Okay. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I was going to actually get to this a little bit later in a presentation, but I'll go ahead and hit it right now. Of that 5.5 million acres that we have, about half of that is actually in federal withdrawals, military reservations, and other withdrawals, most notably the Public Land Order 5150, which is the TAPS pipeline corridor. Those are really valuable lands, and we would like to get those someday. And so we're sort of, in effect, going to keep about that. That's about 2 plus million acres of land. We're going to keep that in our back pockets and just hold on to it. Someday down the road, if a military reservation gets vacated or the Secretary of Interior vacates portions of PLO 5150, the TAPS corridor, then we'll be able to select and acquire that land. The other half of that 5.5 million acres is ours to get anytime we want. We're actively looking at those state selections, trying to figure out which ones we want. Now, as we get down to the end here, things are getting a lot more complicated. We only have 5.5 million acres left. The Native corporations have selected a lot of lands. As part of the Statehood Act, we were allowed to over-select. And so the Statehood Act said we can select up to 125% of our actual 105 million acres. And the same provision went to the Native corporations, so they could over-select 125%. So you have a complex sort of a land pattern now where you have double selections. We have top-filed over Native selections. The Native claims have to be settled before the state claims. So anywhere there's a dual selection, the BLM has to adjudicate that and decide whether to give it to the Native corporation first. And if they don't, then the state selection will attach. Okay? So it is getting pretty complicated. So the other thing that's important to note with the remainder of our entitlement is that we are actually right now over-selected by about 200%, which is actually contrary to the provisions of ANILCA. So the federal government has told us that they want us to relinquish selections.
I'm sorry, say it again.
The federal government has told us they want us to relinquish selections, basically give back state selections, so to get us down to that 125% over-selection. We are trying to hold back on doing that. We're, in fact, pleading with the federal government to give us more time, because we're gathering a lot more data right now. The governor's got a pretty big push on strategic and critical minerals. He's asked for and received money from the legislature to do a lot more field work and data collection for minerals. So the more data we get, the more certain we are which lands we'd want to get. So it's in the state's interest to delay giving back selections until we can get all the data we want. So that's kind of the push. The message is there's really no rush at this point. We don't see for that last 5.5 million acres. We want to take our time, get more data, and make sure that we understand what the resource values are on that.
I just need a little more clarification, because in 1994 we were to finalize our selection. We've got, in follow-up to Senator Wilkowski, the 5.5 million in our back pocket, and then we have the over-selection. So is that 5.5 part of what's been over-selected, so that'll be trimmed down when we get back down to the 125%, or am I missing something there?
Good question.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, the 5.5 is the actual entitlement that we will eventually get, okay? So that's all we're entitled to now. We'll only receive 5.5 more million acres of land, okay? The over-selection, the selections, we were just allowed to select 125% more land than that. So we probably have, and right now we're 200% over-selected. So our selections are way larger than the 5.5 million acres.
Okay.
So.
And just a little further follow up then. The 5.5 is, I understand now that it is, we've over-selected, but we were supposed to select by 1994.
Right.
But yet we're holding off to see if there's some military lands that get freed up. So So how does that work when we were supposed to finalize by 1994?
Okay, so Representative Hughes, again through the chair, the 1994 date was to submit our selections, just the lands that we would like, right? And that was not a date by which we were to receive lands. So the effect of that date is we can't go out and select new lands, right? We can only whittle down the selections that we have currently in place, right? So that's really the impact of that date. It doesn't set a timeline by which the federal government actually has to give us those lands. There's no timeline for that. It's just simply a timeline by which we had to do our essentially our biggest extent of state selections. We can't make it any bigger anymore. It can only get smaller as of 1994.
So some of those hoped for lands were put on the list in 1994 then?
Okay. Correct.
I think this question was answered on Tuesday, but I want to be clear. When the feds make a new designation for lands, parks or wilderness areas, does that come out of their share or ours? Could it come out of our 105 acres, 105 million?
Senator Dyson, at this point, I do not believe so. Our lands are selected on BLM, multiple use lands, and I do not believe that they could. I guess Congress could do anything at this point, right? So
it might.
I think it would be very tough for them to go and at this point start expanding. And again, the state would really fight back on that because, as I'll get to in another slide here, a provision of ANILCA sort of prohibits the expansion of conservation system units. So that would be really, really tough at this point, I think.
All right, thank you. Please proceed.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Wilkos.
Chair. So in the process of selecting the 5.5 additional million acres, is there a list? Is there a map that we can see about what's available? I'd be interested in seeing that. And then what's the legislature's role in this? Are we consulted? Do we have to approve this? Do we have to pass legislation? Or does the governor execute this unilaterally? How does that work?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the first question is yes. We have maps. We can show you all the state selected areas. A lot of those are available on our website, but we can provide the committee with good maps showing what we have selected. In addition to the state selections, we prioritize selections. So that when the BLM starts adjudicating our selections, they know which are our most important lands. So there are various priorities assigned to them. So we have maps showing priorities, and we can adjust those priorities anytime we want. And we'll probably be adjusting those priorities as we get more information on minerals and oil and gas and other values. So and again, we can provide those maps to the committee. At this point, we've made our selections. The commissioner of DNR's authority is to accept these selections and check them and work with BLM to adjust the priorities on these selections and then determine which selections we have to relinquish at some point. So I think it's primarily an administrative branch role.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, so to wrap up this slide, we got our statehood land entitlement initially through the Statehood Act, but there was a lingering issue, and that was that the native claims had not been settled yet. And then in 1968, Prudhoe Bay was discovered, and we had to find a route for the pipeline to the port of Valdez. So that forced the native claims issue. And then the next slide summarizes the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which was signed by President Nixon in 1971. Now, leading up to this, while we were trying to figure out the Native Claims issue, the federal government froze our land selections, land transfers, and rejected all our selections, or at least most of our selections, the key ones that were important to the Native community. So essentially, everything was pretty much put on hold while ANCSA was finalized. That happened very quickly because of the national interest in getting a pipeline corridor set up. During the ANCSA debate, people were talking about not only withdrawing lands and giving those to the Native corporations, but also withdrawing more lands for conservation system units. That issue was tabled in the ANCSA debate, but there was a provision in ANCSA that referred to as the D2 provision that essentially withdrew most of the good lands in Alaska from state selection while the next phase of the debate happened, which is the debate leading up to ANILCA. So you had that 9-year debate called the D2 lands debate, where we're kind of all debating which lands should go into conservation system units and which shouldn't. And quite frankly, not much happened during this period. This is a sort of a kind of a halt to all land transfers and selection activity. Now, I mean, and a lot happened during this period, and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of talk about, I've heard people say that, I mean, a lot of Alaskans were involved in providing resource information to the federal government during this period. There are stories that the federal government took mineral information that they received from Alaskans and drew boundaries to include those. You know, that's, at this point, you know, those are, you know, those are difficult to really get a clear picture of. I think the bottom line is when ANILCA was finalized, Alaska lost a lot. And there were an awful lot of valuable lands that were put aside in ANILCA that were withdrawn from state selection that were now federal CSUs, including a lot of really valuable mineral properties.
Excuse me, was the same true with ANCSA, the Native Land Claims Settlement Act?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I think that happened much quicker because of the...
I'm meaning about the value of the land and the land that was transferred. Did that come out of our account of the lands in the bank or out of the feds? Or?
Senator Dyson, well, in fact, yes. I mean, leading up to ANCSA, all the land selection and transfer activity was frozen by the federal government. And in fact, a lot of our selections that we'd already selected were rejected by the feds so that Native corporations then could select those lands. So there were some lands as far as specific lands and specific values. You know, I'm not sure that we have that information at this point. But, yeah, we did. Our selection pool shrank as a result of ANCSA.
Yeah, that was a question. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Please proceed.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, so... Again, I think I left you at the 9-year D2 lands debate leading up to ANILCA. Again, so in 1980, President Carter signed ANILCA, and that withdrew 100 million acres into all the conservation system units that we now know and are so familiar with in Alaska, national parks, wildlife refuges, preserves. As part of all this, I think that you had asked about some specific examples of things that we lost. I mean, as far as the mineral potential out there, I mean, there are some notable examples, the Orange Hill deposit in Wrangell St. Elias. There were a number of big copper potential deposits in Wrangell St. Elias that were similar to Kennecott that were all put aside in Wrangell St. Elias National Park and Preserve. The Misty Fjords National Monument effectively kind of choked down on the Quartz Hill deposit, which is one of the world's largest molybdenum deposits. And even Greens Creek, even though that fundamentally was preserved to where that could ultimately become a mine, the fact that the Admiralty Island Monument was created really complicated the development of Greens Creek. And even today, we're working with Greens Creek to permit a tailings expansion so the mine can operate further into the future. And that has been complicated because of the issues surrounding the national monument that sort of result from ANILCA.
Representative Isaacson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be real clear, I can't remember. ANILCA was actually passed by Congress, or was it an executive order?
Passed by Congress.
Passed by Congress. Thank you.
Proceed, please.
A couple of things about ANILCA, though, kind of that lead into kind of our modern-day, current-day work. ANILCA was designed to protect Alaskans' rights in a certain sense. I mean, the fundamental principle is a national park in Alaska should be managed differently than a national park in the lower 48, because we're a different state. We have traditional access, needs for traditional access, hunting, subsistence. So Congress recognized that in ANILCA. So it set aside provisions. So federal land managers are supposed to take that into account as they manage federal conservation system units in Alaska. In addition, ANILCA had the no more provisions in it, two provisions that one said, look, the need for parks, wildlife refuges in Alaska has now been met, a very clear intent statement in ANILCA. And so there was that clear no more clause, which, you know, we feel is being really pushed by the federal government to this day in efforts such as the Wildlands Initiative by BLM. I don't know how many letters we've been writing lately where we're like, hey, you guys back off, you're violating ANILCA here. So that's a continual push. We have a shop within DNR that specifically is charged with monitoring federal activity through ANILCA, and they watch, they look at all federal land use plans, they read them, they participate, and they're always going, wait a minute, you guys need to back off here. ANILCA says that we need to preserve these rights. So that's a big job. It's a huge job, actually, and it's a very important job that I don't think many Alaskans realize that is actually happening and how important that is to Alaska.
Yep. Representative Keller has a question.
Yeah, forgive me, Mr. Chair. It's not a question. It's a stomp my feet to emphasize what the Deputy Commissioner just talked about. Those of us that are around when ANILCA passed were offended and frustrated because we saw, for example, over 60% of our land went to the we couldn't touch it, and so therefore we have a kind of a negative visceral reaction. But it's so important to realize what you just said. ANILCA very carefully laid down some protections for us, and we got to pay attention. I also want to compliment DNR and the experts there that have been watching this. And I just, in my role, I have observed, and I just cannot say that Mr. Fogle did not overstate that. We have to pay attention to this issue. Well, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Keller. I'd just like to point out a current example of that is we just received not so good news from Secretary of Interior that we had challenged through some of the provisions of ANILCA the management plan for the Delta River special management area. We felt that had really overstepped its bounds on a number of points. We protested that. The Secretary of the Interior just essentially denied our protest on that. So I'm not sure. We just received that within the last few days. So. Just one last law I'm going to touch on, then I'm going to talk a little bit, well, actually my state selection slide I think we've already covered, but I just want to touch on the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, and that's just one that solidified the federal government's management of the Outer Continental Shelf from 3 miles. The state owns submerged lands out to 3 miles, then from 3 miles to the territorial limit is managed by the federal government. This law just sort of laid out the framework by which the Department of Interior would manage the mineral resources on the Outer Continental Shelf.
Excuse me, sir. There's also a 12-mile jurisdiction. What's that about?
12-mile jurisdiction.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. All right.
Yeah, I'd have to check on that, Senator Dyson. I'm not sure.
All right. Let's assume I'm wrong. Yeah. Thank you.
So, when all is said and done, this map shows the state's land pattern right now. This is a fairly current map. It's not totally current, but it essentially hasn't changed much since this was made. And as we discussed for Senator Wilkowski's question, I think I explained the state selection picture right now. Again, that kind of the overriding message is we're down to the wire, 5.5 million acres left to go. Half of that is military reservations and other withdrawals. We're just going to just hold off on those because those are very valuable lands. We may not see those ever. We may not see them for 50 years, but we think it's prudent to keep them in our back pocket, and maybe someday down the road our grandchildren will be able to pick up some and use some of those lands. The other 2.5 million acres, that's what we have to currently play with, so to speak, and we just want to get more information on those, and we want to push back on the federal government to plead with them to let us sort of hang on to our over-selections for the time being. I would add that in addition to our 105-plus million acre land entitlement, we also have ownership of another 65 million acres of tide, submerged, and shorelands. And that includes, again, tide lands are those lands between ordinary high tide and low tide. Submerged lands are those lands from low tide out to the three-mile limit. And then the shorelands are those lands below navigable waters. And Scott Ogun will be talking to you a little bit more about navigable waters in his presentation. That's a big piece of acreage that we have that is state owned.
Representative Hughes.
You can't see what those colors are, and you don't have to go over them all, but green.
Representative Hughes, through the chair. We'll start with the blue, because that's our entitlement. That's what we're talking about here today. The map on the screen doesn't show it too well, but I think in your hard copies you should come out pretty clearly. The blue lands are about 100 million acres of land to date, right? That's an area about the size of the total size of the state of California. By far the biggest land entitlement of any state in the union. Many states don't even have. I mean, when I go and talk with other land managers and I talk about state land. State land, what is state land? They don't have it in their states, so we're blessed. And again, this land was intended for us to use to to become an independent, economically independent state. The green, those are all the federal conservation system unit lands. That's essentially ANILCA and some of the pre-statehood withdrawals. The pink lands, those are all Native Corporation lands. And then the lighter brown lands are the BLM federal lands that are multiple use lands. Okay, so now, actually that concludes sort of my presentation on Alaska's land history. Kind of condensed, there's a lot more detail, and we can provide that to the committee if they should want, but that's a broad overview of how we sort of got to where we are today.
And it was actually excellent, and exactly what I wanted all of us to understand. And I certainly see a lot of errors in my understanding. I probably owe a formal apology to the federal government on the conveying of lands and the Statehood Act and all that sort of thing. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'd like to conclude my presentation with just a few issues that we've been working on. Commissioner Sullivan touched on this in his presentation about building alliances. So, you know, we are faced with what we perceive as a federal overreach. We're trying to work to push back. On one hand, we're also trying to improve our relationships with the federal government. I mean, they're not going away. We're going to have to keep working with them. So we have to build strong collaborative relationships with them. On this slide, the Interstate Mining Compact Commission is an example of something that is so valuable to Alaska, where we can band together with other states to address federal issues and to air our problems to the federal government. Senator Giesel has introduced Senate Bill 2, which would formally make Alaska a full member of the Interstate Mining Compact Commission, and we'll be having hearings on that. That's something that I believe is tremendously important to Alaska, and I thank Senator Giesel for working and introducing that legislation. But in effect, the Interstate Mining Compact, a compact is a group of states that come together. They all have to enact legislation to become members. And so just a powerful way to make our issues known in Washington, D.C. Anytime the executive director talks, he talks with 23 states behind him. Really powerful. So an example of some of the issues that IMCC is working on, which illustrate the broader issues of federal overreach, the CERCLA 108B issue. CERCLA is the Superfund law. And the Superfund law, in a nutshell, essentially said, okay, we've got a lot of these nasty messes out there that the federal government, that we need to clean up. There are no responsible parties. We should clean those up. But a part of CERCLA also said, we want to make sure that the public is not saddled with the cost of future cleanups. So that leads EPA to conclude that for industrial activity that might possibly create future Superfund sites, EPA now wants to jump in and make sure that the public isn't saddled with that potential cost. And that leads them to this initiative where they are now wanting to essentially take over bonding for hard rock mining in the nation. And that's the first step. They've laid out a plan where they're looking at hard rock mining, then they're going to look at the oil and gas sector, then they're going to look at the energy sector, and kind of march on down the line. This is a huge deal, it's very worrisome, because those of you that have sort of delved into how large mines are regulated and permitted, the bonding part is the very end of a multi-year process, right? And everything focuses in on that, and that's to determine what the costs of reclamation and long-term care would be. And all permitting activity funnels into that. So if you take seize control over bonding, you have the potential just to gut the state's regulatory permitting programs. So all the states, all the mining states in the nation are petrified of this initiative here. IMCC has been the vehicle by which we've all come together to really go to D.C., work with EPA, and try to figure a way out of this box, because there is a legal box that EPA is in through CERCLA. They have an issue, and they have to work it out, and we're trying to be helpful to, like, we see the problem, but you can't destroy good systems. And by the way, in all this dialogue with EPA, it's been pretty clear that they always look to Alaska as a state that's doing it right with respect to bonding and financial assurance. We're an example of how they would like to see all the other states sort of do business more. So,
excuse me. Last year we did a resolution, you know, to both commend you all and to notify the federal government that people of Alaska really support the federalism and the independence of managers like you. I asked Commissioner Sullivan if that was valuable, and he said, yeah, not much, but yeah, and it is. But when push gets to shove, including in trials and hearings, being able to say, it's not just the executive branch, the people here through their representatives support, you know, state control. If you all think that such a thing would be at all useful to you, I suspect we would be glad to speak. We're not looking for work, but we are looking very much to support you and be helpful. So if you want us to do something like to tell us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll take that back, talk to Commissioner Sullivan, and sounds like a good idea to me.
All right.
I'm not speaking for my commissioner at this point. So just to wrap this up again, some of the other things that the IMCC in particular is working on, the Office of Surface Mining is the body that has delegated coal mine regulation to the states. And Alaska has its own primacy program for coal mining, but the federal agency sits on top and watches. And the original idea is for them to delegate that regulatory authority to the states and then sit back and just watch and make sure that they are complying with federal law. In the last few years, they have stepped up. They have what they've called an enhanced oversight directive, and they are coming down and they're scrutinizing state activity way more now than they did, and far more than we think is appropriate under federal law. They're sending federal inspectors unannounced to states to actually inspect the state's inspectors. And it's just all mining states are very disturbed by this. And again, the IMCC is pushing back in Washington, D.C. on this initiative. The Endangered Species Act issues, again, you know, we think we're at the spear point for those with the polar bear issue and all the other issues. Well, there are a lot of issues in the lower 48, too, that where the states are pretty wound up with, especially with the sage-grouse issue in the western states. So the IMCC is really coming together to try and help the states work those ESA issues. Very quickly, because the governor has introduced a bill for wetlands primacy assumption, And so we're going to have a lot of discussion in these committees here, I think this session. But in short, we see a federal overreach coupled with decreased resources for the key agency, the Army Corps of Engineers, as really hamstringing the ability to do responsible development in Alaska. The Corps is losing staff. They're not replacing them. Their budgets are getting cut. We're seeing a giant slowdown in processing of wetlands permits. And I think most of you know, most of Alaska is classified as wetlands, so you really can't have any kind of development in Alaska without without wetlands permitting involved. So, and also, it's kind of important to point out that my second point there, once upon a time, there was a recognition by federal agencies that Alaska is different. I mean, we have a lot of wetlands. We have most of the nation's wetlands right here in Alaska. I think the rest of the nation is about 5% wetlands. We're over half wetlands in Alaska. So we are different. It's clear. There's no one that argues that we're not different. So once upon a time, the federal agencies understood that, and actually they had a joint memorandum between the Corps of Engineers and EPA that outlined that Alaska should have more flexibility in wetlands permitting. We think that the federal agencies really haven't been following that memorandum of agreement to the extent that they can right now, and that's a big concern to us, and we're really working. The new leadership at the Army Corps seems to be very open to working with us to looking at this issue. So that's really important from one aspect. The other aspect is our quest for wetlands primacy assumption now, which we think is terrifically important to the state.
Excuse me, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much of this cooperative agreement that you're trying to enact with the Corps is actually constrained by recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions that basically make any standing water a wetland?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, those Supreme Court decisions, every time one of those comes down, it puts new sideboards on how wetlands are delineated. There's no question about that. There still remains a lot of flexibility, we believe, in the way the federal government interprets how they delineate jurisdictional wetlands. And it's more than just delineating what are wetlands and what aren't. It's the policies by which you set when you disturb an acre of wetlands, what do you do in return, whether you have to reclaim an acre or 2 acres or 10 acres, or whether you have to put money in a mitigation bank and pay someone else to reclaim wetlands somewhere else. Those are all things that are actually really, really important. And as a prime example, we just had some meetings with the mining folks out in the 40-mile district, and they're really afraid that the Corps is now signaling that they may have to charge them $5,000 an acre for wetlands for compensatory mitigation. And these small guys just won't be able to afford that. So we believe that by assuming primacy, we'll have a lot more control over some of these policies, which could make a lot of difference.
Thank you.
And for committee members, I suspect we're not going to get all the information we want and all of our questions answered, in the hour less that we have. And I want you to be thinking about what else you want to know and what other questions, and we will certainly consider having either another meeting or hearing or asking the department to get the packets of those information. So don't feel, we want you to tell us all we want to know, and we want you to tell us all we should know the best you can.
Representative Millett has a question.
Sorry, Representative Millett.
Thank you. Are you going to touch on the National Oceans Policy that's in the works that has been going on and going through the appropriations process and not going through the congressional legislative process on what that means for Alaska and our coastline?
Representative Millett, through the chair, I was not actually planning to go into a lot of detail on that, mainly because it's really something that my department really hasn't been too wrapped into. I know that the governor has a lot of concerns about where the federal government is going with National Oceans Policy. We've been kind of keeping a bit of a distance on that whole initiative and pushing back on it. Quite frankly, I don't believe we actually know at this point where they're actually going to go with this initiative. It's been kind of quiet for a while. So we can get you some more information on that. But I believe my last slide might touch on some of those issues a little bit. So let me go through my last slide, and then we can circle back to that. So again, I'd like to leave a fair amount of time for my comrades here to do their presentations. But I want to finish off with this. That President Obama enacted Executive Order 13580, which is this. It forms the Interagency Working Group on Coordination of Domestic Energy Development and Permitting in Alaska. And the intent of this was to form a group of all the agencies to, as I said, the third bullet just is quoted right out of the executive order. So it's supposed to help permitting and development, efficient development of energy resources in Alaska. We tried really hard when this executive order was being drafted to get Alaska a seat on this working group. We were told no, that this is going to be a federal-only group, and it is. It's a group at a deputy secretary level within federal government that meets with. It's led by Deputy Secretary of Interior David Hayes, and we've been having some communication with this group. It hasn't been very extensive to this moment, but I believe it's getting better. This group is charged with trying to figure out ways for the federal agencies to do their business better in Alaska, and we have hopes that they can see some of the issues that we see, such as wetlands permitting issues, and I do believe they'll be addressing National Oceans policy issues also in all of this, because that's going to be key to energy development on the outer continental shelf. So we actually just had our first meeting ever. I mean, this group has been in place for about a year and a half, and about 2 weeks ago, the state had its first official meeting with this group, in a teleconference. So we'll see. That's evolving right now. I really don't know where that's going to go. But I will point out that the interagency group was tasked by the president to write a report on integrated Arctic management. We got a letter asking us for state input into this, and our first question was, well, what does integrated Arctic management mean? What are we supposed to provide you input on? We weren't really given a lot of guidance, so we did put together a letter that we should have gotten that to you in your packets. There's a two-page letter from the governor, followed by a much longer letter from me, that sort of outlines the state's concerns about integrated Arctic management. And I think our main message to the federal government in this document is we don't need additional layers of governance, such as National Oceans Policy, or any other kind of planning or regulatory activity or framework on the Arctic. You know, all we need is a better, more collaborative relationship with the federal government. You should take a look at this letter. It sort of sums up kind of our position to date on the federal attempt at some kind of integrated Arctic management, whatever that will mean. I don't think we know at this time.
Thank you.
And that really concludes my presentation. So I can entertain questions and then turn it over to Kent and Scott.
Maybe when we get done with the other testimony, we'll have some more.
Sure.
Please proceed.
Yeah. Next. Oh, Kent, you go next. Okay.
Identify yourself, please, for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kent Sullivan with Department of Law, Natural Resources Section. And I'd like to thank the committee and Mr. Chairman for inviting me here today to talk about RS-2477 and what the state's currently doing with regard to RS-2477. RS-2477 arose out of Section 8 of the Mining Law of 1866, and it was later redesignated as Section 2477 of the Revised Statutes of 1878, and that's why it's called RS-2477 for short. It was a simple one-sentence enactment that says that the right-of-way for the construction of highways over public lands not reserved for public uses is hereby granted. An RS-2477 grant is self-executing. And what that means is it comes into being automatically. It doesn't require a court to issue a judgment. It doesn't require a federal agency to sign off on an easement or a right-of-way or a document or to administratively do anything with regard to a right-of-way. It doesn't require the state or any state agency to do anything. What self-executing means is it comes into being automatically when the elements for RS-2477 have been satisfied. At that point in time, a right-of-way arises. All rights-of-ways existing on the date of repeal of RS-2477 in 1977 were expressly preserved. RS-2477 was repealed with the enactment of FLPMA, the Federal Land Policy Management Act, in 1977. But all rights-of-ways that were created between 1866 and 1977 were preserved and continue to be valid existing rights-of-way. And so these rights-of-ways are established and come into being when the elements have been satisfied for their creation, and federal courts have said, we'll look to state law to determine whether or not those elements have been satisfied. And each state has slightly different requirements for showing that an RS-2477 has been validly accepted. Basically, the RS-2477 is a grant by the federal government as an offer for a right-of-way that can be accepted by the states and by the public. In Alaska, that acceptance can be manifested in a couple of different ways. It can be manifested by public use to a sufficient level and degree, and it can also be manifested by acceptance through actions by public authorities. So through governmental agencies or entities doing things to demonstrate that they're wanting to accept the right-of-way. Those are the two ways under Alaska law that these rights-of-ways come into being. Even though RS-2477 speaks in terms of highways, it's important to realize that highways in 1866 meant quite a different thing than highways today. Today we think of highways like the interstate highway system or major thoroughfares with hundreds or thousands of vehicles going across them every single day. That's not what highway meant in 1866. Instead, it meant all things that were being used for travel, all types of travel corridors, foot trails, pack trails, sled dog trails, crudely built wagon roads, and those types of corridors of transportation. That definition has been embraced by Alaska in its definition of what highway is under AS 1945-01-9. Another issue with regard to RS-2477 is where does it apply? Based upon the Act, it arises over unreserved federal lands, but that doesn't mean that RS-2477 only applies to federal land, because as we know, a lot of federal land has went out of federal ownership and is now held by private parties. And courts have said that if an RS-2477 was created at any point in time, it continues to exist irrespective of whose hands that property goes into. So RS-2477s can exist on federal land, National Park Service land, wildlife refuges, Forest Service lands, you name it. And they can also exist, yes.
Excuse me, Chairman. Is native land included in that?
It is.
Okay, thank you.
Native land, land that's been homesteaded, all those different forms of ownership. If an RS-2477 arose when that land was previously unreserved or unwithdrawn, it validly continues to exist no matter who subsequently acquires it.
Thank you. Is there a mechanism by which somebody purchasing land would have a record on their title or plot plans that showed that there was an old route there that might be reactivated under this?
Not necessarily. This is a legal interest similar to prescriptive easements, similar to implied easements, similar to many other forms of easements that don't necessarily show up on title reports and are in many instances incumbent upon the private property owner to investigate their property and investigate its history. Just like when somebody purchases property that, you know, may have had a gas station on it 30 years ago but has been vacant for the past 30 years, you know, there can be some obligation to research what the background of that property was so that you don't get stuck with the cleanup if there should become an environmental issue with that property. Same thing applies with RS 2477, although the state has made effort to legislatively codify a lot of the RS 2477s that are claimed so that the public is aware of what exists out there. The DNR has a database and has maps that show where many of the RS 2477s that have been recognized exist, and people certainly have resources at their means to figure out where these things are, many of them. There's still some that are on there because there's RS 2477s that are being discovered every day, and so they're not all there, but a lot of them are, and there are means to do that.
Just a moment here. So that is not included in what a title company's research should look at?
Mr. Chairman, actually no, because a title company's search is limited to what's of record. And so all a title company will do is they'll research things that have been recorded, deeds, easements that have been recorded. So if there's things that get placed of record that are recorded, a title company will report it and will issue a policy based upon that. But there are exceptions in the title company, in the title company's policy, for things just like RS 2477. They'll make exceptions saying we're not going to issue this, and it is subject to anything that's based upon, you know, use that's obvious and known, or RS, many of them will actually say RS 2477 right in the policies.
All right. Thank you, Representative Isaac.
Thank you. And not to get too far into the weeds, and if you're going to cover this later, let me know, but I have some folks in the Battles area, for example, who are trying to certain RS 2477, have the proof that it meets all the criteria. In fact, you probably recognize the guy's name if I mentioned it. I won't. We can talk later. But what happens when people are asserting primacy and for some reason state or federal folks deny that, even if you have all of this, the supporting document that is required? What's the process?
As Representative Isaacson, through the chair, actually in Alaska, RS 2477s can be asserted in a number of different ways. Obviously, they can be asserted by the state. And they are a state-owned interest, but the courts have recognized the ability of private parties to assert interest with regard to RS 2477 themselves. And there's many cases in Alaska where are between private parties with regard to RS 2477 interest. So it doesn't necessarily take the state. It depends upon exactly what they say and how they do it. And there can be some issues there, but there is jurisdiction of the courts to entertain disputes as between private parties regarding RS 2477.
Follow up. And I guess I mentioned that because you said just now the state has primary assertion, but property owners, it's incumbent upon them to actually search it out. I guess in this, it would be actually utilizing an RS 2477 trail and having that trail access be blocked from time to time and restricted. Is that going to be covered later, or what's the policy to actually maintain a clear highway, as it were?
Yes, Representative Isaacson, through the chair. Every single dispute is different and depends upon the specific facts of that. But in some instances, like I'll get to here, the state has stepped in and initiated litigation to remove blockages across RS 2477s that were caused by private parties. And in other instances, that dispute has been left to the private parties. So it depends upon the nature of each and every dispute and exactly what's going on in that dispute and what the evidence reflects and what have you. There's a lot of these issues that are coming up, and we're seeing them very, very frequently. And so there's a lot of blockage issues out there because there's so many RS 2477s exist, and many of them are across private property. So it's a recurring issue, and each one is a little bit different.
So one last follow-up. So how much time and resources is that taking from DNR to actually adjudicate? What's the timetable that people can expect to have these issues resolved?
Representative Isaacson through the chair. It depends a little bit in the sense of whether this was an RS-2477 that was recently or was previously investigated and codified by the state. If there was, there's an existing file on it with a fair amount of evidence in it already. If it's a completely new RS-2477, it may take a lot more time to take a look at it. And as far as how much time, it could take several years. One of the things I'll mention here is my background is in real property litigation. Prior to coming to this position approximately a year ago, RS-2477s are extremely difficult, challenging, complex cases for a wide number of reasons. They're not like a typical easement dispute or a driveway dispute between two neighbors. And the reason why is because in the typical easement or driveway dispute, you're looking at what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years or the last 6 months when somebody went in and blocked something. You're researching a chain of title that's from the present back to 2 or 3 years. Even in a prescriptive easement case, you're going back 10 years. In an RS-2477 case, in Alaska, even though FLTMA was enacted in 1977, all federal land was effectively withdrawn in Alaska in 1969 based upon the just prior to the state selection and ANCSA. And so effectively the window in Alaska for proving an RS-2477 was from 1866 to 1969. Okay? And in many cases, like with the National Forest, those withdrawals occurred in 1908, 1907. You're having to go back very, very, very far back in time to prove the existence of an RS-2477. In many instances, we don't have living witnesses to do that. Or it can be very difficult to find those living witnesses. And so you're having to research that chain of title that far back. In a lot of our cases, we're having to go back to 1880, 1890, 1900. We're having to discover evidence to prove those claims during that period. It's not like your typical case. We're having to do it through aerial photos. We're having to do it through mining claim information that can be very difficult to locate that far back. We're having to do it through chain of title and historic maps, through records of the Alaska Road Commission, through postal contract, postal records. It's extremely challenging to do an RS-2477 case and to prove it up, unlike a typical case. The other complicating factor is, depending upon whether you have the federal government as a party or private parties, makes a big difference on what court it goes into. You have federal sovereign immunity issues. You have to, under the Federal Quiet Title Act, bring a claim against the federal government under the act, and you have to show a disputed claim against the federal government. And if the federal government is saying, we don't know whether it's an RS-2477 or not, we're not going to take a stand on the issue, many times the court doesn't have jurisdiction for you to sue the federal government under the Federal Quiet Title Act. It can be very, very, very challenging and problematic to bring these in. So it's not a simple, you know, just a month or two, we can figure this out and file something or take a position. It's very involved.
Thank you.
I'll bet you got all the information you wanted.
Oh, it opens up more questions, but that's excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. We're about 25 minutes more. I'd really appreciate if you could cover the issues on this page, the RS-247 Center controversy and so on, and then I'd like to leave about 15 minutes here for the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, Department of DNR, State of Alaska, and so on. And I suspect that we're going to ask you to come back and because this is such an important issue.
You bet, Mr. Chairman. Happy to do that. There's a lot of controversy surrounding RS-2477, and some of the reason for that controversy I'll try to address. From the federal agency perspective, RS-2477, when it was created, it was done in anticipation of planning for travel needs. Okay, we had the the country was largely in federal hands, and yet there was a lot of development and expansion by people in industry growing across the country, and RS 2477 was a legal means to allow people to travel and to create roads and to use roads to get to places without doing it illegally. And that's really what the purpose is. RS 2477 was anticipation of travel planning across the country. However, with the next 100 years that passed, federal land managers really began to emphasize conservation as being their highest priority. And that's what we saw with the enactment of FLTMA. And so there's been a real shift to what the federal government has been trying to do with regard to its focus and its priorities. And even though courts have said that RS 2477 continues to exist and that federal land managers must take into account those valid existing legal rights, federal land managers and agencies have had a difficult time reconciling their current management priority with the continued existence of RS 2477. And from the environmentalist perspective, a lot of environmental groups are fearful that RS 2477 is being used as a land grab. And they're fearful of what may happen if ownership of these rights away and these lands are in the state hands as opposed to the federal government, because obviously they are viewing things from a conservation perspective and are more closely aligned with the federal agencies. Outlook on that. And finally, with regard to Utah's efforts, Utah has been very ambitious and very aggressive in asserting its RS 2477 rights. It has as much federal land as almost any state in the country, I think with the exception of Nevada. And they've been pursuing RS 2477 very diligently for the last 15 or 20 years. Utah has a fairly acrimonious relationship with the federal government when it comes to RS 2477. And unlike Alaska, unfortunately, Utah has some statute of limitations concerns under the Federal Quiet Title Act. As a result of that, they've been forced to bring all RS 2477 claims they might ever have in the state and file them by June of this last year. And because of that, they filed 22 separate cases involving over 10,000 right-of-ways, RS 2477 right-of-ways. And what's happening in Utah is very helpful for Alaska to learn from the things that have proven to work well in Utah, as well as to learn from some of the mistakes that they've made and some of the challenges that they've had. But like I said at the beginning, Utah and Alaska are a little bit different in that the law is different, and our RS 2477s are frankly different. In Utah, if somebody drives across a dry, arid area 20, 30 years ago, half a dozen times, there's probably still evidence of that today. In Alaska, if you stop use on a road for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, you're not going to be able to find it in many instances. And a road 100 years ago, and which hasn't been used for 100 years, is going to be virtually impossible to find. So there's a lot of differences between the state. I can certainly go through this real quickly and won't spend much of any time.
I think I would prefer you hold on. My guess is we'll have you back very soon.
Okay.
You've really done a very good job of setting the background and the issues involved here, and I suspect the individual ones you'll really help illustrate what the issue is. Brief at ease.
What do you want to do on that, Keck?
Representative Keller has, I think, been the chair of the the Citizens Commission, and he's going to explain to us a little bit about what their mission is and how they're going about accomplishing and where they're at. And then we'll have a larger hearing on this in the near future.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, I've been asked many times, what does CACFA do? And I've never had a better context to be able to explain that very briefly. But we work with Ed and Kent and Scott, and we also work with the all of federal agencies. Ed made the comment that we need to have these strong collaborative relationships with the federal agencies and with the various state agencies. CACFA is your liaison, connect, commission that stands, between the legislature and the people that are the experts in this field. And Stan, our executive director, Stan Liepart, couldn't be here. He wanted to be here. We just didn't get the schedules coordinated. So my request would be that at some point we come back with Stan, and we have a CACFA meeting coming up on the February 22nd, 23rd, and we'll have some of the commissioners here. And as far as who's involved in this, CACFA was reinstated by Representative Mike Kelly when he was here, just so you know, and he was very active. Some of you may know Rick Shakora. I gave you all copies of our newsletters that come out regularly. You'll see the commissioners on there, and I suspect you'll see names that you recognize and respect. And thank you for letting me make this plug for CACFA and make this request for a future date.
And I'm really sensitive to you all's time, and we have really profited from what you're saying and teaching us, and probably another session of it is. We have both Tuesday and Thursday next week that could be available to continue this. Which of those would be inconvenient or perhaps most convenient for you all?
So I guess, Senator Dyson, we can make anything happen that would suit this this committee. I personally have some other travel plans for next week. Thursday is something that I would not be able to do. I could adjust and maybe make Tuesday, although I think the key for you would be to have Scott Hogan and Ken Sullivan back here to sort of keep drilling down into some of their presentations. So
Sullivan's a good second stringer here. Thank you. So Tuesday would be better for you, because Thursday is absolutely excluded.
Right.
All right. I think we're still off the record.
Correct. You're talking about it.
What else do you have for us that we should know?
Well, Senator Dyson, if the committee would like in the few remaining minutes, I wouldn't mind it if Scott Ogan can give you sort of a brief tour on our through the world of navigability and what we're doing in that realm.
We would be delighted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also like to introduce my Director of Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Brent Goodrum, who's sitting behind me to my left, and the Deputy Commissioner used the word comrades, and I think in that context that he meant is that we, you know, we're all in this together. We've got a really dynamic team. We've had a tremendously rewarding career working in DNR, and the full support of the leadership from the governor's office on down, and I appreciate that very much. I'm the manager of the Public Access Assertion and Defense Unit. We have a mission statement of protecting the Alaska lifestyle, which I believe is under being eroded by federal actions through the assertion and defense of access to Alaska's public lands and waters. We deal with a number of statewide policy issues, statehood entitlements. We review all the statehood entitlements to make sure that RS-2477s are asserted, that the federal government is not conveying away submerged lands that are rightfully belong to the state, and that's been a big problem in the past. Don't want to, you know, cast any stones, but we didn't do as stellar of a job. You know, it's kind of been like a ebb and flow of a tide. There's been times we've paid a lot of attention. There's times that we weren't paying attention, and the feds have actually purported to convey lands that we believe belong to the state. And it's a great source of it's better to catch it now than have the conflicts later. My shop does the RS-2477 research. I have a team of professionals that supports Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan was hired through a increment to the budget that the legislature was kind enough to give us last year, and works under an RSA through my shop. And it's wonderful to have a gentleman that focuses entirely on one issue, because we have good attorneys in Department of Law, but they're often pulled by like Gumby into 10 different directions. And Kent's sole focus is RS-2477. It makes a tremendous difference. And then we look at the Native Claims Settlement Act easements, which are 17B, known as 17B easements, and that's Section 17B of Native Claims Settlement Act. And we have a right to make sure that those checkerboard patterns of Native claim conveyances do not block access to public lands or waters. We have a very good track record of appeals. We've batted 1,000 so far in every appeal we've brought before the Interior Board of Land Appeals, which is we call IBLA. It's an administrative law judge panel that, and we've got, again, good support from the Department of Law on those. And I do make a lot of the day-to-day litigation strategy decisions. We defend title to submerged lands. I guess I covered that before. I'm overseen by a group called the Interagency Navigability and Access Team, and they're high-level members of both the Department of the Natural Resource Department, Fish and Game, and Department of Law. Kent's boss is one of the person that's a representative of the Department of Law, Elizabeth Berry. Tom Brookover is on Fish and Game, and Wynn Menefee is my direct supervisor, and he's also part of this team. So they take a look at it from those three perspectives and give us guidance on making the decisions, you know, on the major decisions, like where to litigate. And I'll cover some of this stuff. You know, we all know about the equal footing doctrine. I think we're admitted to this, to the union, on equal footing with the rest of the states. And the federal government said, you own all the lands that are beneath waters that are navigable for travel, trade, and commerce purposes. Have a nice day. Which ones are those? We're going to be sorting that out for a very long time. There's a number of cases we look at. Daniel Ball case, it goes back to the actual Civil War days. More recent cases are the Utah Salt Lake case, where whether there was a federal withdrawal for a power site, and whether or not that defeated state title. Utah won that case. We have Kandik Nation, which is were adjudicated by the Ninth Circuit as navigable. We have a controversy on the Nation River right now with a gentleman named John Sturgeon, who was cited for running his boat on that river. His actually, it's a Hoover craft. Gulkana case is kind of a landmark case for Alaska. The lower 30 miles of the Gulkana River were determined navigable by a standard which of a raft capable of carrying 1,000 pounds. Or like, and it's a susceptibility case. PPL Montana, which is a power company, sued the state of Montana over the state of Montana is trying to charge them for rents for a power dam site, and the Supreme Court recently weighed in on that, gave some more clarity, but it affirmed our position about if the river doesn't have to actually be used for travel, trade, and commerce, if it's susceptible to be being used for travel, trade, and commerce in its natural and ordinary condition, then it belongs to the state.
Sorry to interrupt.
No worries.
Our House members have to go into session here at 10:30,
okay.
And I'm very sorry that we aren't able to get by this time all of your presentation, which has been very valuable, and we're going to have to impose upon you again and soon, and please excuse that we missed it all, but you're part of the problem because you have provided so much very valuable information and expanded our world. Is there any other business? This Representative Lynn.
I'd just like to thank the folks who presented here today. Very serious issues involved here. We need to maintain our state sovereignty. I'd like to thank you. Looking forward to working with you again. Contact us anytime.
We'll adjourn.